Before I begin today, let me open with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, our Heavenly Father, you are indeed heavenly. You are the one who created the heavens and the earth. You've established your throne in the heavens, and your sovereignty rules over all. And any human authority we have has been delegated by you. And we rejoice that the world you created is a world that's structured, it's orderly, it is rational. And therefore we can know it and understand the fringes of your wisdom, but at least we can glory in understanding some of it. Pray, dear Lord, that you would teach us, grant us understanding this day as we ponder Socrates and Plato, these two philosophers in ancient Greece, as they respond to the skepticism and relativism of the sophists, which is rampant in our day. So give us wisdom as well, we pray, to respond to the sophists in our day for the glory of Christ, for your glory in all things, and for our good. We ask all this in Jesus' precious name. Amen. Well, last time we met, we looked thoroughly at the sophists, a group of several philosophers at the end of the 400s BC. And they, as we saw, were individuals that thought that this world was unknowable. They believed that our physical senses that see and taste and touch and hear and smell everything around us, that our physical senses do certainly experience things, but they did not believe in objective knowledge, knowledge outside of our own mind. They believed that human sense perception is real, but objective knowledge is not possible. So that was pure skepticism. And the only thing that each person has then really is his own perception of the world, which is called subjectivism. And we mentioned that the philosophers of ancient Greece could be divided into those that are pre-Socratic and those that are at the time of Socrates and afterwards. So Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle are in a different camp of philosophers than the pre-Socratics. Just imagine the world of the sophists, where they accepted this notion that man is the measure of all things. Each person's perceptions are true for him and only him. Each person has my truth, even though it may contradict and oppose someone else's perceptions of the world. Universal words like justice, goodness, truth, and beauty are meaningless, since the sophists only believe individual, particular perceptions are real of a constantly changing world. So it's the idea that this world is nothing but becoming, nothing but changing. And all the world has is chaotic individual things floating around. Is like an irrational stream of organic matter, of individual things just floating around. For the sophists, all is becoming. There is no being. There is no structure and order. There is no essence of anything. So in the sophist's mind, everything that people talk about order, is solely human construct, human conventions, things that humans have imposed upon the world. And in the sophist mind, then, that order can be anything. And we see that in our day, where a man identifies as a woman or a woman identifies as a man. They think anything can be anything, because to them there's no order or structure her essence of anything. All things are nothing but becoming, nothing but change. Darwinian evolutionary theory has that too. It's saying everything is evolving, and that's all it does is evolve. So if you, in taxonomy and biology, where you go kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, all of these various categories, to a true evolutionist, it's solely man-made. Really. Because it's all evolving, it's all changing, all the time, to them. There's really no structure or order, just random chance changing. But they did believe human perception was real. But nothing could be outside of my own subjective mind, and that's why it's pure subjectivism. My perception of reality is my truth. And you may have a different perception of reality, and that's your truth. And that's the way they function. It's pure relativism, relative to the person or subject. I want to review just a little bit of the pre-Socratics. That before the Sophists, the initial pre-Socratic philosophers assumed the perceived order in the world was real. And then they primarily focused their attention on speculating about the fundamental arche or stuff of which physical things are made. So Thales, we looked at him, died 546 BC, usually regarded then as the father of philosophy, accurately predicting the solar eclipse, you remember. But Thales died 546 BC. He believed all is water, the fundamental arche or stuff of which physical things are made. He said all is water. Anaximenes died 528 BC. He believed all is air. Anaximander died 546 BC. He believed all physical things are boundless. And Pythagoras died 500 BC. You remember behind the Pythagorean theorem. Pythagoras believed all is number. And to him, number was not just an abstract idea, but numbers were real things, physical things, different than the way we view numbers today. Pythagoras, you remember, also believed that humans have not just a physical body, but a non-physical soul that is divine. The Pythagorean school had a religion of Orphism, if you remember, that did believe that humans have a non-physical part, a soul, that's spiritual, but they believed that was divine. What is God? Most of the pre-Socratic philosophers believed the perceived order being in the changing world, becoming, was real. They most believed that the perceived order was real rather than an imaginary mirage. Men remain men, horses remain horses, rivers remain rivers. Order in the world, perceived by Thales, the founder of philosophy, allowed him to predict a solar eclipse that happened on May 28, 585 BC. Only if the perceived order in the world is real can it be rational and therefore understood by the human mind, allowing accurate predictions. Because it's orderly and there's a pattern, therefore you can predict when a solar eclipse will take place again, if it's happening on regular patterns. There's a regular order to the world. Heraclitus, another pre-Socratic philosopher, died 475 BC. Heraclitus believed that the source of that perceived order was something he called the Logos, a non-personal physical power within nature, is the way he looked at the Logos. A non-personal physical power within nature, but that which caused the order to exist. And he was the first philosopher that we know of that put forth the word Logos to explain the structure and the order of the universe. Parmenides, who died 430 BC, believed the physical world exists eternally and absolutely, and therefore all perceived change in the world is an illusion. Parmenides was the pure rationalist, and therefore he said the only way you can truly believe that there is the essence of anything is for there ultimately then to be no change. Because he had an either-or fallacy. If something changes, there's no way there could be an essence to it. Remember, in Christianity, we say that we have both being and becoming. I'm a human being, and as well I change, and therefore there's becoming. There's both by the providence of God. But to Parmenides, in his mind, it was an either-or situation. If you see change, then there cannot be essence, but there has to be essence for things to have knowledge and be rational and understood. So therefore, the change you see is therefore a mirage. It's imaginary. It's not real. And as we said, he was probably the most pure rationalist in the history of philosophy, Parmenides, who died in 430 BC. Empedocles, around 450 BC, he agreed with Parmenides to the degree that the world began as Parmenides believed it exists. One solid, unchanging essence, being. But then opposing forces in nature that he called love and hate started things in rational motion. That was Empedocles. Anaxagoras, who died 428 BC, believed the world is composed of both matter and mind, being both physical and spiritual, and for him, mind explains rational motion. That's Anaxagoras, who died 428 BC. So you're trying to say, what is it that explains the structure and the order? Heraclitus would say logos. What is it that explains the source of motion? How did that begin? And Anaxagoras would say there's something in the world called mind. Democritus lived 460 to 360 BC. He believed rational motion is eternal and therefore needed no explanation. You're not wondering when it began because motion has always been in his mind. And each one of these we've spent time looking at, okay, of the pre-Socratics. The sophists came out of all of that disagreement and said, well, I guess it's unknowable. They embraced pure skepticism and relativism. But we see that some of the pre-Socratic philosophers believed in the metaphysical spiritual world, though most of them were secular materialists. Most of them said the material world is all that there is. But some of them said there's other spiritual things a part of it, like Pythagoras, believing in the actual spiritual soul. R.C. Sproul had that four-part category of monists and pluralists, and some were corporal monists and corporal pluralists, and some were incorporal monists and incorporal pluralists, corporal being physical. Some were physical, some non-physical, and they embraced all as one or all as many, fundamental many for the archaean fundamental stuff of all things. But some of them embraced the metaphysical spiritual world. Others were pure secular materialists. They did vary. But after all that philosophy, thinking about the fundamental archaea stuff of all things, the fundamental source of order and structure, if it exists, and if motion is truly existing, what is it that caused it? After all of that philosophy, grounded in the belief of a rational world, that it could be understood, it was rational. All the philosophers were pursuing a rational view of the world. It was followed by that wave of sophist skepticism and relativism. And then comes Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle to defend both objective science and universal terms like justice, beauty, truth, and goodness. So they come along then to defend objective science, objective knowledge of this world around us And they defended universal terms like justice, beauty, truth, and goodness, which we're going to talk more about, what we mean by that. Socrates lived 470 BC to 399 BC. And we cannot discuss Socrates separately from his most famous student, Plato, who lived 427 BC to 347 BC. Again, we're counting down to Christ. And the reason we cannot discuss them separately is because no writings of Socrates remain. We have no writings of Socrates. Some would argue maybe he didn't write anything down. But we do have the dialogues of Plato. He wrote many dialogues, many writings in the form of dialogues. And in them, Socrates is a typical character that's arguing against the sophists. Now, you can say, if we assume that Plato's intent was to accurately portray his teacher's beliefs in his dialogues, then we know what Socrates believed. But there is some debate whether Plato's intent was really to accurately portray his teacher Socrates. We do not know exactly. But if we assume that was his intent, then that's where we know what Socrates believed, is in the writings of Plato. In those dialogues that Plato wrote, Socrates appears in them arguing time and time again against both the skepticism and relativism of the sophists. And in doing so, Socrates argued that objective reality exists and is knowable. And it includes metaphysical things like justice and goodness, truth and beauty. And we'll get to what we mean by metaphysical, beyond the physical, meaning something spiritual. All things in our physical experience undergo constant change. Right? We've got the wind blowing right now. The clock is ticking. I'm 1 second older. Everything's changing around us. The earth we're sitting on right now is rotating on its axis. It's moving. We have a heliocentric universe. In our solar system, it's a solar system, and we're orbiting around the sun. Our Milky Way galaxy is also in movement. Everything's in movement and change and motion in our physical world. In other words, there's becoming. Everything's in motion and change. But there's also a rational structure and order to the world. There's being. And that's what he's seeking to defend. We know, as we've said, whatever is rational is knowable. The irrational is absurd and unknowable. The insight of Socrates, this is what R.C. Sproul points out. What was the real insight of Socrates? Is he realized that knowledge and virtue are inseparable. That knowledge and virtue are inseparable, so much so that virtue could be defined as right knowledge. You say virtue. Virtue is this idea of good behavior. Virtue, and the opposite of it is vice, bad behavior. What is virtue? And he had the insight to say virtue is right knowledge. Right thinking and right doing can be distinguished from each other, but they can never be separated. Right thinking and right doing can be distinguished from the other, but they cannot be separated. And it is here that we can see why Justin Martyr, who died about 165 AD, the greatest of the second century AD Christian apologists within the early church, Justin Martyr regarded Socrates as a kind of Christian before Christ, as the historian Nick Needham points out. You say, well, why is that? Again, Socrates' insight was realizing that knowledge and virtue are inseparable. Right thinking and right doing can never be separated. So what do we find in Romans chapter 12, verse 2? Christians must be transformed by the renewing of their minds. Because right thinking brings about right living. That's an insight of Socrates. The first imperative, the first command in the Apostle Paul's letter to the church at Rome commands Christians to reckon or to consider in their own minds that they are spiritually reborn. Romans 6:11. That God made them new creations in spiritual union with the risen Christ. Romans 6:1 through 10. Now when he died to sin, you died to sin. When he was buried, you were buried. And when he rose in newness of life, you rose in newness of life. Spiritually, you're born again, a new creation in Christ. So reckon or consider it to be so in your minds. Right thinking begets right living. And that's why we are to seek as Christians and are empowered to seek in union with the risen Lord Jesus Christ, obedient, virtuous lives. As Romans 6:1 says, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid, may it never be. Right thinking precedes right living. Knowledge and ethics are inseparably linked. Now, Gordon Clark, I've referred to him before, he was a Christian philosopher in the 1900s AD, just in the 20th century here, just a few years ago. Gordon Clark said this, for the first time in Greek thought, with Socrates, for the first time in Greek thought, they examined with great care the relation of knowledge and ethics. Along with the pre-Socratic philosophers, Socrates was scientific. He was scientific. He rejected the official pagan gods and goddesses of Athens and ancient Greece, which in fact was one of the official charges that were brought against him, condemning him to death for his philosophy in 399 BC. But Socrates believed that the source of knowledge was within the soul of each human being, which he believed was a divinity. Socrates believed that each human being did not just have a body, but had a soul, and the soul was spiritual, and that soul was a divinity, a god. And in this sense, Socrates is like Pythagoras, who believed humans have souls that are divine. Pythagoras died 500 BC. So Socrates believed in a metaphysical reality to man, a non-corporeal soul, a non-physical soul. This is the issue in our day as well. Are you as a human being solely physical, just a physical machine, and that's it? Or are you also composed of a spiritual part? Right? The Christian view is we have two parts, body and soul. Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. Well, this is something that Socrates also embraced, that we have two parts, a physical part and a spiritual part. It's just in his mind he deified the spiritual part, the soul. Socrates believed every person could find objective truth by looking within himself. That's where we have that know thyself, that phrase, that kind of goes back to Socrates. And then using what became known as the so-called Socratic method of asking deep questions and challenging assumptions. So look within, think carefully, ask challenging questions, take on your assumptions. And this method of discovering truth is called the dialogue. The dialogue, literally called the dialectic. The dialectic. And such communication depends on accurate definitions, which Socrates constantly pursued. Because if you believe objective reality exists, and you're trying to explain that objective reality, what words you use to correspond to that reality is important, how you define them. And therefore, in the dialogue, in the dialectic, accurate definitions are critical. And in the dialogues that Plato wrote, Socrates, as one of the characters that is in many of them, is pursuing and interacting with the sophists, trying to define terms carefully. Remember, with the sophists, universal terms like truth and beauty and goodness and justice have no meaning. They're just mere words for the sophists. Socrates argued that universal words like justice, goodness, truth, and beauty exist as part of reality. That they're not mere words, but real things. He did not want you to give him an example of justice, but to define justice that applies to every single example of it. If I go to Luke 23:41 and to the believing thief at the cross and say, well, what is justice? Each one getting their due. And then you can give me multiple examples where people are getting their due. Small crime gets small punishment. Big crime gets big punishment. One who was given 2 talents and got 2 more talents gets a reward, right? Rewards as well with punishments, part of justice. Socrates once said, beauty remains after the rose fades. Beauty remains after the rose fades. And what he meant by that was that beauty involves being, since it does not change. It is something real. And it is something we recognize exists. And it's not something that's in isolation to a particular object. Because then when the rose fades, it's done. And this is the difference in words when you speak of universal words versus particulars. Okay, this is big in the history of philosophy. Think about it a minute. I can say, Thermu, you're a man. And Sue, you're a woman. But God created man in his own image, male and female. But can you point to man? Like in the Declaration of Independence, the idea that God created man. There's an equality of creation. That we have an essence, a being that does not change. Even though you're short, you're tall, right? Some are babies, some are old people, but we have the essence of a human being. And that's the same with beauty. Beauty remains after the rose fades. He was fond of arguing, Socrates was, in Plato's dialogues with the sophists, of saying, you guys recognize that some people are wiser than others. So that assumes, though, that there's a standard by which you're judging them by. It's outside of them. And that's the same with beauty. You say, well, this person is ugly, or that flower is ugly, or this tree is ugly, or this, but this other is beautiful. Well, what standard are you judging it all by? There has to be an objective outside standard that exists outside. That's real. Beauty is outside of the subjective mind of the beholder. That it is truly a part of the order and structure of the world. Socrates once asked the question, do we say that justice itself is something or nothing? Do we say that justice itself is something or nothing? The pre-Socratics sought to know the fundamental arche or stuff of all things, and many of them assumed that all of reality was physical. Some of them believed some of reality was metaphysical. And this is where Socrates is saying, hey, there is metaphysical reality. There's reality beyond the physical. Meta, supernatural, is another term for that. Something supernatural, above nature, metaphysical, something that's spiritual. If justice is real, if it's really something, then it exists. It exists, even though it is not discernible with our physical senses. You can point to a man, but you can't point to man. You can point to a horse, but can you point to horseness? You can point to a chair, but can you point to chairness? That's what we're getting at when we think of universal terms. A universal is not a particular. It's not a particular chair that you're sitting in right now. But why is it that you recognize a chair from a table, no matter what different shapes chairs are in? But you just know in your mind somehow, chairness. This is the idea of a universal word. And they're in these categories where we say, this is in the category of a house, or a river, or man. Justice, truth, beauty. Where you're not pointing to one example of it, but a definition, a universal term that applies to everything that would fit in that category. And it's a real thing, is what Socrates is arguing. But they're non-physical. They're non-physical. You and I can't point to it, the universal. You point to a particular example of it, but it in itself is real and yet non-physical. It's metaphysical. But knowledge is possible of these universal realities because they are just that, real things. They themselves, though, are not physical, but real things. If justice and goodness and beauty are real things, then they can be taught. Now, it's interesting. In the dialogues of Plato, it points out that Pericles, if you remember Pericles, one of the rulers during the Golden Age of Athens, he had none of his sons study justice. None of them go to a school and study justice. Isn't that what the Republic is to be about? Enacting justice among the citizenry? And how it relates with foreign affairs? To act in a just manner and not be unjust? And yet Pericles had no sons study that, study justice. And yet Socrates, in the dialogues, interacting with the sophists, and says, but don't you study music? Don't you send people to a music teacher to study music? Well, justice is something that's in the realm of knowledge, just like music. Even though you can't point to physical reality, it is something that is in the realm of knowledge and something that can be taught. We can grow in our knowledge of the beautiful, the good, the true, what is just as a music teacher teaches music. Gordon Clark, the Christian philosopher of the 20th century AD, he states this: Socrates is seeking for a system of morals which, like geometry or the laws of navigation, does not change, but is natural and common to all men. If virtue should be knowledge, then and only then would it be teachable. As a subject, just like 1 + 1 = 2, and that is common and the same whether you're in Burma or whether you're in the United States or in Europe. 1 + 1 = 2. And you can teach it. And he was looking for a system of morals that is the same for all, common to all, universal to all, and in a body of knowledge that can be taught. And he was arguing it exists and it is knowable and teachable. Again, he's reacting to the sophist that says everything's relative. Don't tell me stealing's wrong. Maybe that's your perspective of reality. I have a different perspective. Man is the measure. And I have my truth, you have your truth. Anything goes. That's the world he's arguing in, you see. It's the world we live in, and we want to look at the world the same way as Christians and say, hey, there is a common system of morality for all people. It's a body of knowledge that can be taught. It's summarized in the Bible. That's why we begin with Western civilization in Jerusalem. And in particularly, the moral law of God summarized in the Ten Commandments, in all of the underlying principles of justice for neighborly relations in the judicial law of ancient Israel. It's the same way of thinking, you see, of reality and of morals as Christians. Again, that's why Justin Martyr would look at Socrates as a kind of Christian before Christ. Regrettably, not every one of Socrates' students learned his lessons of virtue, because several former students of Socrates were among the 30 tyrants that rampaged Athens right after it lost the Peloponnesian War to Sparta in 401 BC. Then 30 tyrants were in place. The democracy fell, Athens lost the Peloponnesian War, and democracy was destroyed in Athens. They had 30 tyrants, though, that were appointed. And some of those tyrants had been students of Socrates. And they rampaged Athens. But the democratic forces again rose up, reinstituted democracy in Athens. And the Athenian polis then turned against Socrates in 399 BC. They condemned him to death for several things. One I already mentioned, for not worshiping the gods whom the city worships, because he rejected the mythical gods and goddesses of Athens in ancient Greece. They also accused him of introducing religious innovations they didn't like and of corrupting the young men, where some of his students were involved as the 30 tyrants. So they got their revenge against him. Well, Socrates himself, he'd been a valiant, honorable, courageous citizen soldier for Athens during its tumultuous golden age. He was a good soldier for Athens, not just a philosopher. And he was truly a man of virtue and wisdom among the people. He lived as he believed. He didn't fall into the decadence of excess wealth and immorality like most of the Greeks, even though he was an idolater. But rather than escape punishment by fleeing, he could have chosen exile, the humiliation of exile, which then would have been acknowledging the falsehood of his teaching. Rather than do that, he didn't want to renounce his beliefs as false, so Socrates drank the poisoned cup of hemlock and died a martyr for his philosophy. And also, one of the reasons he did that is he believed his soul lived on after his death. He believed in the immortality of the soul. Now, Gordon Clark does go into discussions of whether or not they believed in reincarnation. You do find some insinuations of that within Plato's dialogues, but it's unclear, Gordon Clark says, whether they really believed that, because Plato had lots of different stories to try and explain transcendent things, metaphysical things. But one could certainly say that Socrates believed in the immortality of the soul, that it lived on after death. Obviously, dying a martyr for his philosophy in 399 BC, let's just say, put him on a great pedestal in the history of philosophy. Now we move into Plato. One student in particular learned Socrates' lessons of virtue better than anyone else, and his name was Plato. John Frame, Christian theologian, philosopher in our day right now, he says this: Plato was the greatest student of Socrates and one of the greatest philosophers of all time. Say it again. Plato was the greatest student of Socrates and one of the greatest philosophers of all time. And you say, well, why would John Frame say that? Well, John Frame says this: because Plato was able to bring together the paradoxical views of Parmenides and Heraclitus. Parmenides, you remember, said fundamental reality is being and permanency. He was the pure rationalist. Where Heraclitus said that fundamental reality is basically becoming and change. Because even in that quote of Heraclitus, which we talked about, where he said, of those stepping into rivers staying the same, other and other waters flow. That fundamental reality is change, according to Heraclitus. Now, that's where some misstate his quotation and say, you cannot step into the same river twice. That's the way many people state Heraclitus. How is it, again, that you take these two opposing things? That's what Parmenides was struggling with. That's what Heraclitus was struggling with, and many of the other pre-Socratics. That when we look at the world around us through sense perception, we see nothing but change. And yet, with our minds, we see these categories of things, that there's structure and order. How can there be both? How can there be both? And in John Frame's mind, who is not just a theologian but a philosopher, he says the greatest philosophers are those that can kind of bring in and synthesize opposing views. Okay? R.C. Sproul looks at it like a Hegelian analysis, where somebody put forth a thesis, all is the same, and an antithesis, all is change, and then a synthesis of the two, bringing them together. There's both structure and order and permanency. There's being, and also there's change, becoming. How do you do it? And in Frame's mind, Plato is one of the greatest philosophers of all time because he found a way to bring those two paradoxical views together. They're apparent contradictions. Okay? That's what a paradox is. They're an apparent contradiction that upon further analysis you can reconcile and bring together. Now, what Plato's solution was is to say there's two worlds. That the universe exists as two realms of reality. Two realms of reality. One, a metaphysical spiritual world with ideas and forms. And then the other is the physical world of becoming that our senses perceive. So in a sense, then Plato synthesized the two perspectives of Parmenides and Heraclitus, saying that the spiritual metaphysical world is the realm of being, unchanging, permanent ideas and forms that are perfect. And then there is, well, the physical world known through our physical senses, and that is the realm or world of becoming, of change. In the spiritual world are the pure ideas or forms of horse, river, man, etc. All these universal forms or ideas. And that's where, again, how is it that you can look at different types of cats or different types of dogs, but you know all those various sizes of cats, that's a cat. And all of these various sizes of dogs, you say, that's a dog. And all of these different types of chairs, you know, that's a chair. How is it that we come to that? And that's where he would say there's this world of ideas and forms, and it's a metaphysical world that's real, and it involves the essence or being of all of these things. Significantly, Plato said that these ideas or forms are real. So much so that he said they are the primary reality in a world of real things. In a sense, he would say they're more real than the physical world you see, taste, touch, feel, and smell. That this world is a shadowy world. That we live in the shadows. The imperfect copies and echoes of that ultimate real world that's more real, the realm with ideas and forms, the spiritual realm. In beautiful objects, we see an echo of true beauty. And we are moved by passion to seek the form of beauty. In beautiful objects in this physical world that's always changing, in beautiful objects, we see an echo, an imperfect copy of true beauty, is the way Plato would think. And then we're moved by passion to seek the form, the perfect essence of beauty. So, in a sense, Plato was both an idealist and a realist. He was both an idealist and a realist. You have an idea of man. You have an idea of justice. You have an idea of riverness. You have an idea of a perfect universal concept, right? In his mind, though, this is idealism, but in his mind, those ideas aren't just ideas that exist in abstract, they're real. It's reality. There's a real spiritual realm with pure forms and essences of things. And therefore, he's a realist, not just an idealist. The physical world in which our physical senses experience reality is an imperfect shadowland. There was a movie that was done about C.S. Lewis, toward the end of his life when he married a woman who came down with bone cancer. And it's called The Shadowlands. You see a lot when you read C.S. Lewis. He understood Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. And trying to utilize their philosophy against the sophists of our day. If I stand out in the sunshine right now, I'm the real thing, reality, right? And then you see my shadow of me, a shadow on the pavement. And in his mind, that is an analogy to the two realms, that there's pure beauty, there's pure justice, there's pure horseness, pure catness in this realm of the metaphysical world. That's a real world, and it's more real than the shadow. You and I, with our physical senses, live in the shadows, seeing nothing but imperfect, changing copies and echoes of the real, perfect forms, ideas. Physical things in this physical realm of the Shadowlands are the receptacles. That was Plato's term. They're receptacles of their perfect ideas or forms in the metaphysical world. The chairs and rivers and horses and men we experience in this world are imperfect copies or echoes of the ideal forms. But our minds recognize a chair from a table, though they're imperfect, because our minds recollect or remember the perfect essence of a chair. He has in his theory, his philosophy, the idea of recollection. How is it that we have that? Well, our soul recollects what we prior knew. He has the idea of innate ideas. For Plato, our souls are eternal. Our souls are eternal, and our souls lived in that metaphysical reality with pure forms and ideas. And therefore, when our souls are imprisoned in our bodies, which had a beginning, our souls recollect or remember the pure forms that it once knew and experienced in that perfect realm of the metaphysical spiritual world. But to Plato's mind, the knowledge that we have right now that is recollected or remembered of that perfect metaphysical world with perfect ideas and forms, the knowledge we have of it right now, the recollection or remembrance, is blurred by the physical body in which the soul is imprisoned. And this is that idea that many quote along the ideas that our physical senses warp reality, blur it at times. This was a big thing with Parmenides. Can you really trust your perceptions of reality? And he said, all is essence, no becoming. All is being, no becoming, no change. The change you observe and perceive is a mirage. It's not real. Well, Plato wouldn't say that, but he would say that our bodies, in which our souls are imprisoned, blur, through the physical senses, blur the recollection and remembrance of those pure forms, of pure chairness and catness and beauty and justice. Emphasizing the mind, Plato said that knowledge comes by human reason, reasoning and thinking. And Plato put above his academy, then he started an academy by Athens, and he put a sign above his academy, let none but geometers enter here. Let none but geometers enter here, mathematicians. He visited the Pythagorean school. Pythagoras died 500 BC, and that school continued after Pythagoras' death. Remember, Pythagoras believed in an eternal soul that in his religion of Orphism was divine, and Pythagoras believed ultimately the arche or fundamental reality of all things is numbers, that numbers were real things. Well, this is where Plato was highly influenced by that as well, and to say, okay, the soul is eternal. It had this experience of the metaphysical realm that does not change and has pure being, pure forms of justice and beauty and truth and hoarseness and catness and riverness. And then that soul gets imprisoned in a body in a point in time in human history in this changing world. And in this changing world is the realm of becoming. And that body in which the soul is imprisoned blurs through its physical senses, blurs the remembrance of the pure forms. But it's this rational thinking about life, especially with mathematics, then, which math is symbolic logic, by which one gains understanding. Because ultimately, only that which is rational and structured is knowable. And it's through the human soul, in Plato's mind, that's eternal, that once lived with the pure forms and pure ideas, the essence of things, that's what gives rationality to everything. If you don't think there's specific categories, and if you don't believe that there's the essence of things, and all there is change, well, all you have is absurdity and irrationality. You cannot speak to me of rivers and horses and cows and cats and man, because everything's evolving and changing. You may evolve into a cow for all I know. You see? Everything's evolving and changing. If it's not in orderly and structured, it's not rational. If it's not rational, it's not knowable. But this is his way of saying this is why it's knowable. It's rational. But he wanted only geometers to enter his academy who would be rational in thinking along those lines. Plato's view of the eternal human soul, combined with his rationalistic love of mathematics, evidences the influence which the religion of Orphism within the Pythagorean school had on him that he had visited. For Plato, the true philosopher cannot be satisfied with empirical or sensory knowledge, pure scientific knowledge of things. It's kind of the way philosophy began, right, with Thales and the Milesians, looking for the fundamental arche, or stuff, of which things are made, and they were scientific. They were natural philosophers being scientific, and he would say, though the true philosopher cannot be satisfied with merely empirical sensory knowledge of things. The true philosopher reaches for the essence of things, for the ideals, the pure forms of things. True truth, as Francis Schaeffer would say. That's what the true philosopher and theologian is seeking. True truth. The essence of things. The true philosopher seeks the essence of justice, beauty, truth, and goodness. Not a particular example of it in our physical world that dies when that physical thing ends. Plato's philosophy then rises above the skepticism and relativism of the sophists. So, again, he was able to explain in his philosophy order and change by thinking about two realms of reality. A metaphysical reality of pure forms and ideas, the essences of things, that our eternal souls once lived in, and then when we're imprisoned in a body, we have remembrances and recollections of. And that's why we're with real reality, we see structure and order in this changing realm that are shadows and imperfect copies of that realm. To illustrate the interplay of that world of being with the world of becoming, Plato used the analogical language of a cave. Use the analogy of a cave. Picturing men chained in a cave since childhood, able only to see the shadows of people moving and carrying things cast on a wall from a fire behind them. So picture these men since childhood chained on the wall of a cave, but the way the structure of the cave is, there's a fire behind them, and there's people moving things and carrying things and talking, and all they see, those men chained in the cave, is shadows on a distance wall. And they even think those shadows speak because the people are speaking. But behind them, it's real people moving things, carrying things, and talking things, but their shadows are cast against the wall. This is all these guys chained on the side of the cave see and experience and hear through their physical senses, is the shadows. And they incorrectly think the shadows speak. Their senses kind of fool them, living in the shadowland there of the cave. As R.C. Sproul notes, for Plato, knowledge that is restricted to the material world is at best mere opinion or at worst, ignorance. For Plato, knowledge that is restricted to the material world is at best mere opinion and at worst, ignorance. If all it is dealing with scientific material knowledge. So, according to Plato, the role of education is to lead people out of the shadows that they're accustomed to living in, taking them out of the cave of physical changing reality into the light to see the primary reality. The metaphysical world of unchanging ideas or forms that exist. And then Plato has some discussions where you know, you go from pure darkness to light and it hurts your eyes. People don't like it. And they resist it. But he sees then teaching, education, and the root of that word for education is leading one out. So the idea of leading one out of ignorance, leading people out of the shadows that they're accustomed to living them, taking out of the cave of constant physical changing reality into the light to see primary unchanging reality, the metaphysical world of perfect ideas or forms. And in doing so, then, people will seek to live both individually and socially in the polis according to that metaphysical order. This is where we distinguish, as I said, between the pre-Socratics and Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, we have the founding of political philosophy. Political philosophy. How should we live socially? How should we structure our republic, our civil society? They're the first philosophers to think about that. And this is where, when with education, drawing people out of the shadows into the light, getting them understanding, teaching them about the essences or forms of things, the perfect ideas of things, that people will live both individually and socially according to the metaphysical order that they gain knowledge of. For Plato, virtue is knowledge. Just like Socrates, virtue is knowledge. One never does wrong except out of ignorance in Plato's mind. That's Plato's mind. Okay, I'll interact with that in a minute from the Bible. To Plato, one never does wrong except out of ignorance. And if one knows what is right, he will necessarily do it. That's Plato. That the fundamental problem of the human race is ignorance. If you only knew the essences or forms and ideas, the real structure and reality of things, rather than living in the shadows of your physical experience, it's always changing, you will change and fit your life and the life socially of the Republic according to that form and reality of the way things really are in the more real world, the metaphysical world. And in his view, no one would ever knowingly do wrong and go against that. Well, significantly, the Bible says in Hosea chapter 4, verse 6, where God says to the prophet, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. So Plato's partially true. But is the problem sheer ignorance? No, it's not. It's willful ignorance. Willful ignorance. Because Hosea 4, 6 continues, because you have rejected knowledge. So Hosea 4, 6 says this, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge because you have rejected knowledge." You've willfully refused it. It's willful ignorance. Willful ignorance is repeated in Romans 1, 21. That although they knew God, the problem fundamentally is not ignorance. Although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. They willfully refused that knowledge. that's revealed in creation. Romans 1:20. The eternal power and Godhead of our Creator. That's clearly seen by the things that have been made. But even though they knew God, they refused to glorify Him and be thankful. Willful ignorance. But that's where Plato's partially there, see? He's partly there. As a pagan philosopher, John Frame, that Christian theologian and philosopher in our day, states this: Plato's major interest, like that of Socrates, was to tell us how to live. His metaphysics and his epistemology, how do we know what we know, are all a prelude to his ethics and his political theory. I'll say it again. Plato's major interest, like that of Socrates, his teacher, was to tell us how to live. His metaphysics and his epistemology, his view of reality, are there metaphysical things that are not physical, but pure ideas and forms of justice and beauty and goodness and hoarseness and catness, the ideas that are real, the metaphysics and his epistemology, how we know what we know. And he had his theory of the eternal soul and the recollection and remembrance, are all a prelude to his ethics and his political theory. Now think, similarly, Christians are commanded to set their minds on heavenly things and not on earthly things, right? Colossians 3:2. If you've been raised, Colossians 3:1, if you've been raised spiritually in Christ Jesus, seek those things which are above, where Christ is seated at the Father's right hand. Set your mind on heavenly things, not on earthly things. There is a metaphysical reality, a heavenly reality, and we are to set our minds on that metaphysical reality that's beyond this world that we would say is cursed by sin. The inspired Apostle Paul writes to the Christians at Philippi in Philippians 4, 8 and 9, "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you." Christians are to meditate on universal, metaphysical terms and ideas that Paul has both taught them and lived out before them as a particular example. And they're real things that you and I are to meditate upon. Now one can see why Clement of Alexandria, who died in 215 AD, one of the early church fathers, referred to the noble and half-inspired Plato. He referred to the noble and half-inspired Plato because Plato had much that's thinking like a Christian would think against the relativism and the skepticism of the sophists. You and I believe a metaphysical reality exists. You and I believe that knowledge is virtue, that we are to meditate and reckon upon heavenly things, reckon them to be so in our lives, and right thinking begets right living. And that is why Clement of Alexandria, one of the early church fathers who died in 215 AD, referred to the noble and half-inspired Plato. Nevertheless, Plato was an idolater. R.C. Sproul states that the perfect idea of the good was Plato's God. The perfect idea of the good was Plato's God, Plato's idol. Certainly an idol, for sure, but to Plato's credit, there is an extent in his philosophy that he denied that human beings are gods. That's the result of the philosophy of the sophists. Since for the sophists, man's individual perception of reality is always true and right. For the sophists, each individual man is autonomous, a law unto himself. For the sophists, I have my truth and I'll live life the way I want to. I did it my way, as Frank Sinatra sang. That's the sophists. The lie that Eve embraced from the serpent, you shall be as gods. That's the way the sophists lived. My perception of reality is true, period. And what Socrates and Plato have argued is that there is a metaphysical reality outside of your individual mind, that you and I must structure our individual lives and our society according to that reality. And only then will we have the good life. For Plato, there exists an objective reality and order outside of man's soul, and he must order his soul and life and society according to that metaphysical reality. But how does the order of the human soul relate to the order of the polis? Polis is the political society. How does the order of the human soul relate to the order of the polis? For Plato, the soul of man has three parts: reason, will, and appetite. What some would call reason, spirit, and appetite. We have an intellect, a human mind that reasons, and we have a will that makes choices, pursues things, and we have appetite, desire for base earthly things, food, drink, sex, etc. So for Plato, the human soul has three parts: reason, number one, number two, spirit, will, whatever you call it there, usually will, and number three, appetite. For him, for Plato, moral conflict takes place within each human being when the reason and the appetite pull in opposite directions. In his mind, the will is kind of like holding the reins between two horses. The human reason, more thinking about the metaphysical realm of pure forms and ideas and the essence, the way that things are really ultimately structured and ordered. And the appetite of man in his soul that purely desires the base things of food and sex and drink. That's when moral conflict in Plato's mind takes place, where there's the conflict between what's rational and what is pure appetite. Where the human reason understands valuable goals according to the metaphysical world, but the appetite is the animal hunger for physical things. The spirit or will of a human being is his bent toward action and should be under reason's influence. For Plato, the good or virtuous life is dominated by contemplative reason. Where's the good life? Reasoning, thinking. Let your mind control you, not your base desires that are physical base appetite desires. Don't be like an animal that acts by instinct for food. Human reason is the dignity of humans. It's a very Christian way of thinking as well. But for Plato, the good or virtuous life is dominated by contemplative reason of the ideas or forms of the metaphysical world. The sophists had embraced relativistic chaos of both the will and appetite for individual human beings in the polis. Russell Kirk, he was a political scientist in the 1900s AD, just a few years ago, in the 20th century AD. Russell Kirk said this: in opposition to the sophists, Plato's whole endeavor was the recovery of order. Order of the soul, order of the polis. I'll say it again. Russell Kirk noted that Plato's whole endeavor was the recovery of order. Order in the soul, order in the polis. Against the chaos of the sophists. That's where we're at right now. We've got to think about that in our society. We want the return of order, order in the human soul and order in our political society. Right? That's what we want. That was his whole endeavor. It's my endeavor ultimately to the glory of God in Christ Jesus. Plato knew that these two kinds of order are not identical and yet cannot be separated altogether. That's Russell Kirk's assessment. Plato knew that these two kinds of order, the order in the human soul and the order in political society, Plato knew that these two kinds of order are not identical and yet cannot be separated altogether. So, if there is disorder in the polis, in the republic, in civil society, then you know that there's also disorder in individual human souls who comprise the republic. Because the human soul is fundamental. Now, that's a huge insight. That the order in the soul of a human being and the order in the polis can never be separated. But they're linked. That's a Christian way of thinking, and it was of thinking at America's founding. For Russell Kirk, political scientist from just a few years ago, he said Plato, in his Republic, he wrote many works, many dialogues, but he wrote one work called The Republic. And it's many times misunderstood as if he was communist or Marxist or whatever else. And what Russell Kirk says, it will not be understood correctly unless one understands that Plato believed society is man written in large letters. Plato's The Republic will not be understood correctly unless one understands that Plato believed society is man written in larger letters. Society is man written in larger letters. Think about it. Plato said that man's soul has three parts. Reason, will, and appetite, right? As man's soul has three parts, the imaginary polis of Plato's The Republic has three classes of people. The philosopher rulers corresponding to man's reason. The fighting men, the soldiers, corresponding to man's spirit or will, and the cultivators of the soil, the farmers, corresponding to man's appetites. Say it again. One will not understand Plato's The Republic unless one understands Plato believed that society, the polis, the political society, is man written in larger letters. As man's soul has three parts, the imaginary polis, political society of Plato's The Republic, has three classes of people. The philosopher rulers corresponding to man's reason, the fighting men or soldiers corresponding to man's spirit or will, and the cultivators of the soil, the farmers corresponding to man's appetites. And it's the farmers that are the largest group. The appetites. A good republic, then, in Plato's mind, a good republic demands wise rulers acting according to reason, and each class remaining in its own place, fulfilling its own responsibilities, receiving its own rewards. The philosopher rulers, as guardians of the polis, receive contemplative leisure. The fighting men, the soldiers, receive the glories of war, and the cultivators of the soil, the farmers, receive material wealth. Each has its hierarchical place in the polis, as each part of the soul of man has its appropriate place as well. So, to reform the polis, one must reform the human soul. If the polis, if society is man written in larger letters, to reform the polis, one must reform the human soul. What would Charlie Kirk say to people? You need Jesus. You need Jesus. We know that our polis needs reform. But to reform the polis, you must reform the human soul. And how is that truly reformed? We know in Christianity only through Christ. Do you see how he was a noble and half-inspired man, Plato? For Plato, no reform at all can be possible if we fall prey to the vagrant, base impulses of will and appetite, or if we submit ourselves to the evil counsels of the typical sophist. That's the assessment by Russell Kirk. It's got to be according to reason, according to understanding the metaphysical realm that exists of the essence of things, the true forms and ideas that are perfect, and aligning our individual lives according to that, and therefore aligning the polis according to that, the civil society. So we could say, certainly similarly, the founders of America knew that a just and good republic depends on a moral people. That's essentially saying the same thing. That a just and good republic depends upon a moral people. And for the founders of America, as predominantly Christians, where does the morality come from? The true reform of the human soul? But through genuine faith in Christ Jesus. As Charlie Kirk said, you need Jesus. In Christianity, the Bible provides specific moral commands and laws and statutes for ordering our individual lives, our marriages, our families, our businesses, and our society. We went through that in many lessons when we went through Jerusalem. Western civilization began in Jerusalem. And we went through the Book of the Covenant. We went through Leviticus on holiness. We went through the Torah and Deuteronomy. In the Pentateuch, in the Book of the Law, through Moses, we went through all of the specific commands, ordinances, and statutes and laws of God relating to us as individuals, our marriages, families, businesses, and society as to neighborly relations. The dilemma for Plato, and this was his problem, is that his abstract ideas or forms leave all specific ethical questions unanswered. The frame of thinking is decent, but with Plato, you still have generalities. You still have generalities with regard to the morals of what the good life is. In other words, once one identifies goodness as an abstract form, one cannot derive from it any specific content. That's John Frame's assessment. It's the limitation of the human mind by reason alone. You have a conscience, you have a sense of what's right and wrong because the law of God's written in your heart, but human reason, without the Bible, only goes so far. What does it really mean to tell the truth? What does it really mean to protect private property and not steal? We can go on and on, but this is where the details are not there, which is human reasoning. What truly is goodness? We have to go to the Bible to get the details. That's what I argued repeatedly when we went through Jerusalem at the beginning of this course. But you see, the framework of his thinking is good. In many ways, even though he's a pagan. So such is the main limitation of rationalism. The human mind and conscience by themselves can only go so far. For all of Plato's shortcomings, though, one must acknowledge the brilliance of Plato and his teacher Socrates in preparing the Greek world for Christianity. And that was the view of many of the early church fathers, is that the philosophers of ancient Greece, particularly Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, prepared the Greek world for Christianity. Because their way of thinking, in the broad terms, is a Christian way of thinking. Even though it fell short and was still a pagan way of thinking. Though Plato's God was not the true and living God of the Bible, Russell Kirk summarizes Plato's life and times quite well. And I'll end with this. These are the words of Russell Kirk. Plato had been born in the year 427 BC, 4 years after the Peloponnesian War began. Began in 431 BC. Plato had been born in the year 427 BC, 4 years after the long Peloponnesian War began. He was 28 when Socrates was put to death. At the age of 60, he had endeavored to make a philosopher king of the younger Dionysius in Syracuse, a large Greek city and island of Sicily south of Italy. But he failed in trying to institute a philosopher king there. He died in 347 BC as King Philip of Macedon was about to march into Greece, ending the freedom of the Greek city-states. So he died again in 347 BC, just at the time that King Philip of Macedon, the Macedonians, was about to march into Greece, ending the freedom of the Greek city-states. Plato had lived from the great age of Greece into Greek decadence. In his last dialogue, called The Laws, Plato affirms, quote, "It is God who is, for you and me, the measure of all things," unquote. Now, he had a different view of God than we do. It was an idol. His pure form of goodness was his idol, his God, as R.C. Sproul noted. But this is against the sophists who essentially said, man is the measure of all things. We are little gods, and we will live as we please in all things. We're a law to ourselves. We are autonomous. That's the way the sophists taught. That's the way the sophists lived. And against that, Plato said no. In his last dialogue in the Laws, Plato affirms, quote, "It is God who is, for you and me as human beings, God is the measure of all things." God, it seemed, had weighed Hellas, the Greeks, in his balance and found it wanting, is what Russell Kirk notes. And it was judged and never again had a glorious day. Now, the next time we meet, my plan is to go into Aristotle, Plato's student Aristotle, and then just summarize a bit the Republic of Sparta, which was a real long-lasting republic. It was an oligarchic republic, not a democratic republic as Athens had, but it was an oligarchic republic, but it had unique structure in it that's worth thinking about as we're thinking about the Republic of America and the Republic of Rome that we'll be moving into. Different other republics in Western civilization then. They're a mixed democracy, and there's various mixtures of the best of monarchy, the best of aristocracy, and then as well the best of democracy, and how you mix them together, and there's different ways of mixing them in a republic. So Sparta had its own unique mix, and it's worth thinking about, at least in the history of Western civilization. So that's where, Lord willing, we're going to look at Aristotle and then look at the oligarchic, the aristocratic republic of Sparta, and then we'll be moving into Rome. So we started Western civilization, began in Jerusalem, and then we've gone through Athens. We'll be finishing that, Lord willing, shortly, and then moving into Rome, and then we'll be traveling through there to London, and then to America, Lord willing.